Now, I'm delighted to say that in the studio with me, I have Lindy Taylor. Good morning, Lindy, for a start.
Good morning, Donny.
And thank you for joining me, even though you do have a little bit of a cold on you.
But yeah, just a bit.
You're
yeah,
very so good for coming
me,
in.
My coughing at you.
That's fine. Now, a lot of you will remember that some time back on a Tuesday edition of Northside Today on Noel's programme, an interview was broadcast that I did with Lindy much earlier in the year, where she was basically trying to, I suppose, locate the remains of her... What was the relation again? Grandaunt, was
grandaunt,
it?
Yeah. Grandaunt. My grandfather's sister.
Who joined a religious order, went to the front line in World War One, and unfortunately was gassed and died. At the time we were talking to Lindy, she... That's about really as much as she knew. She didn't kind of know what order. She had a kind of a feeling that maybe the grandaunt, even though she was a religious person, that maybe she might have lied about her age and she mightn't have been as old as she thought she was. Loads of different stuff like that. But not wanting to beat her own drum, but Lindy came to one of the recordings of our Dublin during the Great War programmes, which you recently heard broadcast here on Near FM 90.3. As a result of attending, Lindy met somebody, and now Lindy is going to tell you the rest of the story.
Yes, it's very exciting. I had done a lot of research into my family history, and a lot of it was through actually Raheny Heritage Society, which we discussed as well, because we do have monthly meetings on genealogy. But I was stuck on this girl, Hannah Taylor, because there was no records of her. I didn't know what happened, only the family story. But through coming on this show, I met a lovely lady, Jennifer Wellington, who is a lecturer in modern history in UCD. And I eventually got hold of the picture. My aunt had sent me up a picture of Hannah Taylor, this nun. And through her, she sent it on to one of her colleagues, Professor John McCafferty, who sent it round Europe, effectively, saying, can anybody identify the congregation? Which nun is it? We had thought Notre Dame, but I got an email back eventually to say that it was actually they could definitively confirm it was the Congregation of Bon Secours de Paris.
So basically, that all came from the bit of detective work revolving around the habit.
The nun's costume.
The nun's costume.
Yeah,
I was going to say uniform, but you know what I mean anyway.
Yeah.
Because each order has a slightly different
habit.
Insignia on them.
And the way they wear the uniform and the way it's cut and what they wear on their head, apparently, it's all different. So these guys were experts in this field, and a definitive guy from a professor in London said no, it was most definitely Bon Secours de Paris. They could confirm.
Excellent. So I presume that religious orders being religious orders, that they had records and kept records.
They did indeed. I had originally, when I was tracing her, because she was from Cork, she was born in Cork in 1893. So I went originally through all the nursing orders in Cork.
She had a good start anyway.
Yes, she did. But I had no joy with any of the nursing orders in Cork. They hadn't any record of this Hannah Taylor at all. And I had tried the bonds before. But now I knew definitively she was most definitely a Bon Secours nun. I could get back onto them and say, no, I have proof that this girl was a Bon Secours nun. So I got on to a Sister Mary Bradshaw, who's in charge of their historical archives down in Cork. And again, she said, look, no, she hadn't come through Cork. If she was nursing in France, if she had gone to France and was nursing in France, she would have gone to France to join the order. If she had joined in Cork, she would have stayed in Cork.
So now we can definitively say that she was born in Cork, but did she have any medical experience at all prior to going to France?
No. According to the 1911 census, she was a dressmaker. So I'm assuming if she was born in Cork, they were Catholics, she would have had a convent education. So she would have had contact with the nuns. But she would have had no prior experience in nursing at all. So she had to join a convent to be a nurse. Unless she had gone and become a voluntary aid nurse, she would have had to go to England and join the voluntary aid detachments as a civilian. But she obviously wanted to do it through her Roman Catholic Irish heritage, which was the nursing was through the nuns. So she had to go to France to become a nurse if she wanted to nurse during the war. So she went to Paris. She took her first vows in Paris on the 24th of May 1915. Sister Mary Bradshaw, she put me in contact with the French order, who came back with this information that they could definitively confirm that Hannah Taylor was indeed a sister of the Congregation of Bon Secours de Paris.
And as a matter of interest, Lindy, do you have her religious name? You know, the way that they don't... She was Sister what?
Yeah, it was part of the record. She took the name Sister Saint Alexandra, which for me actually is kind of revealing as well, that she specifically chose that name, because I was thinking, why did she go? Why did she want to do this? I had discussed previously in our interview that I felt it was out of a sense of duty, but I couldn't definitively prove that. You know, she could have had a young man who broke her heart, who had died. We didn't know. But the Saint Alexander is actually the defender of humanity. She was martyred defending humanity in the late 3rd century, early 4th century. She was a wife of an emperor. So she had converted to Christianity. So the fact that she took this name, Saint Alexandra, kind of would indicate to me that she did go out of a sense of duty, that she, regardless of the personal cost, that she wanted to do her bit.
And do we have any way of knowing, Lindy, while she was in France studying to be a nun and taking her orders, and, you know, judging by what you're telling us in the build-up, it would appear that she pretty much had her mind made up that this is what she was going to do, and she was going to put herself, in no uncertain terms, in harm's way. Do we have any knowledge of whether there was any contact between the family in Cork and her, or what the family in Cork were thinking about all this?
I don't. Unfortunately, you know, I only have my auntie Maureen, and as I said before, she would have been born after Hannah died. And this story is only coming out now. I had never heard this up until I started researching. I can only assume, you know, like as I said before, the rest of us, we set our mind on a court of action. We have a very high sense of duty and a very honed sense of what is right and what is wrong. And we will do the right, what we feel is the right thing to do, regardless of the consequences and regardless of how unpopular it may have made us in the family. It may have made her extremely unpopular, because at that stage, you know, by 1915, stories are coming back. It wasn't the war that would end it at Christmas time. There were stories coming back of the horror of the trenches and the horror. And I'm sure her parents didn't want her to go. She had a life in Cork. She was a dressmaker. Why would you want to go off and put yourself in harm's way? But she obviously felt that this was what she wanted to do. It was her calling. I don't know what. It was the right thing to do. It was a sense of duty. And to do it in Cork, she wouldn't have got there. So she had to go to France. Having spoken to Sister Mary, she said that, you know, there was absolutely no way she would have gone to the front if she had joined up in Cork. So she deliberately put herself in harm's way.
Okay, so we have a date when she took her orders, her vows.
Yeah, we have the 24th. She took her first vows in Paris on the 24th of May 1915.
So, and that date is important when you hear the next date, I think, Lindy, isn't it really?
Yeah,
it puts her life and as a person really into context.
It does. I mean, it's very poignant. It would have been around her 22nd birthday she took her vows. She was born, I think, in May 1893. So she was just 22. And from the sisters, they told me that she wouldn't have stayed in Paris. If she was nursing, she would have been moved all around the Western Front. She would have been moved wherever there was a battle and wherever action was needed, she would have moved from nursing station to nursing stations to treat the wounded. So she didn't stay in Paris. And unfortunately, okay, it wasn't the Somme, which we had originally thought, but it was the Western Front. And there was a number of actions towards the end of 1915 where the British were trying to retake the area around the Marne. They didn't have a definitive cause of death, but the story was gas attack. And since I proved everything else is accurate, so I'm going to go with that. But she would have been nursing in one of these stations on the front, and gas, at that stage, the British were also using gas, so it wasn't just the Germans, and they were using mustard gas. Now, that did not kill you instantly. That burnt your skin, it burnt your, you know, into your lungs, it burnt out your lungs. So she would have literally died choking on her own blood, if that's, you know, exactly how she went. I am still trying to find a death certificate. But it turned out that this young girl died on the 29th of January 1916. So just over 7 months later, this young girl was dead. And she died at a place called Rosay-en-Brie, which was about 40 miles from the Western Front, certain parts of the Western Front. She apparently is buried in Rosay-en-Brie. And again, I had to try find out where, because there were a number of cemeteries in Rosay-en-Brie. So I got hold of the sisters again, and they said there was a convent at Rosay-en-Brie that has since been sold to another organisation that deals with handicapped children. But it's at 10 Rue de Vipre, and the nuns' plot in that hospital now is still there, is still kept as a nun's plot.
So the final part of the jigsaw for Lindy now is, at some stage in the very near future, take Auntie from Cork on an airplane and lay a wreath of flowers on Gran Aunt's grave.
Absolutely, yeah. That is my goal now, is to actually get over there. It's amazing, actually, because you can go onto Google Maps now, and I actually put myself in front of that convent. I stood in front of the convent on Google Maps, and all I want to do now is get there. I want to take my aunt, go over and pay my respects to this hero. I mean, at the end of the day, she was a hero for me, and she sacrificed her life to do her duty to help other people. And for me, that's a hero. So that's what I hope to do. You know, it's going to be hard because my aunt is elderly to try organise that, but we will most definitely get that organised. And I'm glad I got the opportunity to do it in my aunt's lifetime, that I can say, yes, this is her, this is where she is. And it's weird, Donnie, it's even just proving that she actually existed, that this was real.
Yeah,
that
because
it wasn't just a story.
Yeah, up until you made contact with Jennifer Wellington, it was a sort of urban myth, something that was talked about on and off in the family, but there was no definitive hardcore facts, whereas now you have all the facts in place. And can I ask you, Lindy, that we'll say that the first time I spoke to you was part one of the interview. We'll call this part two.
Yeah.
Can we do a part three when you come back from France?
Absolutely. I will definitely go to France. I will take as many pictures as I can. I will talk to as many people as I can, because, you know, the French do also revere the fact that these people did, who weren't French, did sacrifice their lives for the greater good at the time.
Well, it's a fascinating story. Yeah. And it, I suppose, in a way, Lindy, doesn't it really maybe illuminate the Irish way of doing things, that it's not what you know, it's who you know, and wheels within wheels, and how things happen.
Yeah.
Lindy, we'll park that for the moment, because now that we have you contracted to a third interview. St. Patrick's Cathedral, talk to us.
Oh, yeah, I do tours in St. Patrick's Cathedral. As you know, I'm a tour guide up there for the summer. And it's a wonderful, wonderful place. You know, we have a huge area in the North Transept dedicated to these men who sacrificed themselves during World War I. It's sad some ways because people come in and, you know, we get people coming in and it's not Roman Catholic, it's an Anglican cathedral. Both our cathedrals are Anglican. And there can be issues with that. And then they see what they see perceived to be British flags. They're not British flags as such. They're regimental flags of Irish regiments and battalions who would have fought in the British Army. We, up to 1922, we were part of the British Empire.
We were the second city, actually.
Yes, and there would have always been Irish men fighting in regiments in the British forces. And we have flags dating back to the Napoleonic Wars. You know, so it wouldn't have been uncommon for Irish people to see it as their duty to go off and fight against an enemy that they perceived to be in the wrong. So these men equally would have sacrificed their lives to do what they perceived to be the right thing. And for different reasons. Some of them went because they needed the money. Some of them went because they were in clubs and, you know, sports facilities and they thought it'd be a really good adventure. I mean, people didn't realise the horror of the war until much later. So these battalions, when a battalion is disbanded...
And not wishing to cut across you, Lindy, but there is absolutely no way, and I mean, it came out as well in that World War One, our Dublin and the Great War documentary that we made here. There is no way, even in this day and age, that any recruiting officer is not going to try and sell a recruiting drive for a war as anything other than glamorous and victorious,
yes,
and manly.
Yeah.
They're not going to tell you, listen, this is the reality.
Yeah,
you
you're
know what
go
I mean?
Over and get slaughtered.
Yeah.
Good luck. No, I mean, it is. And you know, this is the thing with history. It is remembering to put it in the context of the period we are talking about. You know, and in the context of that period, it was a different world. It was empires. It was Victorian ideals and a Victorian society. So there was a heightened sense of duty and morality and everything that went with that period of history. And that did completely change after World War One. I mean, this idea of nations and nationhood developed more profoundly after World War One. And people fighting for countries as opposed to fighting for empires. So, you know, I'm not going to judge these people, but it is a wonderful memorial to these soldiers. I mean, we have one example is a flag to the 4th Battalion of the Royal Dublin Fusiliers. They were the first ashore on V Beach in Gallipoli in 1915. And 1,000 men went ashore and within 36 hours, you had 600 dead and 300 wounded. So the battalion was disbanded and their colours were hung in the cathedral. And that would be very, very common. And they hang until they fall.
And it is a hugely, you know, popular tourist attraction. And
You
were telling me before we came on air, I mean, the statistic, it's where is it in the rankings?
It's the fifth most visited tourist attraction in Dublin. You know, you have Guinness's, obviously, in the zoo and places like that, and Book of Kells. But St. Patrick's is right up there, and it's the largest cathedral in Ireland. It's a fantastic building. If I had a euro for every Dubliner who had never set foot in St. Patrick's Cathedral or Christchurch,
I wouldn't be a tour guide.
I'd have retired years ago.
And that's really, I suppose, is the point of me addressing it, which is the fact that it's on the doorstep and so many people haven't used it. And, you know, it is right on their doorstep and it is a fantastically interesting place, isn't it?
It is. I mean, we also have Jonathan Swift, you know, who was Dean of St. Patrick's between 1713 and 1745. And he was a huge advocate for Irish causes and Irish social issues and humanity. And this is the contradictions again. We get people coming in and it's Protestant and, you know, we're Catholics and this is Protestant and whatever. But, you know, Dean Swift was Protestant. That didn't make him any less Irish or any less an advocate for Irish social issues. And it's separating this idea of this Irish Catholic nation that was promoted, that to be Irish you have to be Roman Catholic, to be a nationalist you have to be Roman Catholic. It's not. It's accepting all these different aspects of our cultural heritage. And that's what we try promoting in St. Patrick's, that this is another aspect of our Irishness.
And the times for tours there, Lindy, for anybody listening who would like to pop along and have a look, and just even to walk into it and just stand and stop and absorb the atmosphere.
Yeah, we do. Now, there is a charge to visit the cathedral because in Ireland we recognise all religions equally. So there is absolutely no state funding for our churches. It costs €7,000 every day just to keep that building open and functioning as a church. Now, we have regular services. Obviously, there is no charge to come and pray in the cathedral. We are first and foremost a house of worship. But to maintain the building, we have to function as equally also as a tourist attraction. It's fairly cheap. It's £6.50 for adults and £5.50 for students and seniors. And if you get groups together, it's cheaper again, over 10 people. We open the doors at 9 o'clock in the morning, and we close at 5:30 in the evening, or 5 o'clock actually is usually our last entry if we have a service on. 6 o'clock at weekends if there's no service on a Saturday. We do guided tours are included in your entry. So our guided tours are at 10, 10:30, 11, 11:30, 12 in Italian. And then in the afternoon at 2:30, 3 and 3:30. And these are provided by either staff or volunteers. We have a wonderful host of volunteers who come in and do help out and do tours in the cathedral. And they're part of the entry fee. Music is a huge part of the cathedral as well. We also have a lot of visiting choirs who come and sing during the lunch time hour between 1 and 2. And they are also free with your entry. But unfortunately, if we didn't charge to enter, we wouldn't have a church.
Lindy Taylor, thank you so much for coming in. It has been informative on so many fronts. Please come back and tell us how you got on your excursion to France. And I'd be most interested to know how your 98-year-old great-grand-aunt enjoys that trip. Lindy, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Tony.